Shrink Wrap Radio number 754, Lisa Bravo, PhD, on how to speak to your extremely difficult teen.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Lisa Bravo, PhD. She's the author of the 2021 book, The Bravo Effect, Strategies for Parenting Extreme Teens. Lisa Bravo, also known as Teen Whisperer, is a highly acclaimed psychotherapist, speaker, author, and teacher. She holds a doctoral degree in behavioral health from Arizona State University and maintains a thriving practice in Scottsdale, Arizona, as an expert in family dynamics and adolescent behavior. Today's episode is brought to you by EveryPlate.com. Now, here is the interview. Dr. Lisa Bravo, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. And this is your first book by yourself.
Yes,
And so I want to congratulate you. And the book is called The Bravo Effect, Strategies for Parenting Extreme Teens. And so were you like, you know, first of all, I should ask you, how did you come to write this book?
Well, I'm in private practice in Phoenix, Arizona. I've been working in the field of behavioral health for more than two decades.
Okay.
And I have two children of my own that have grown and flown. One's still in the nest. He's got one foot in the nest, but he's on his way. And I just really, over time, have tried to, the way that I work with teenagers especially, I found has been very effective. And I've had many parents ask over the years, you have to write a book because this isn't available. The way that you work with teenagers is not available anywhere in writing. And it would make it so much better for parents if they had a guide. So yeah. I really wrote it in terms of like giving them a blueprint or a framework for raising their teenagers.
Yeah. And I have to say, going through the book, I really got that this is very specific in terms of the advice that you're giving. And not, you know, of course, there are some generalizations, there have to be, but it's very concrete and it's unique, I think. That's the key thing, because I've read other books on parenting, but this one definitely stands on its own as unique. And were you an extreme child yourself? Does this come? And what do you mean by an extreme child?
I'm very happy that you asked that question, because I think, you know, I think this book is largely for all parents who struggle with teenagers. But I really focus on extreme behavior because I've had so many parents over the years. You know, the most common question I get from parents is this normal? Is this okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of times it is developmentally appropriate during this stage. And sometimes it's out of the box and it's beyond what is in the realm of normal. So I really wanted to delineate that for parents, so there's not a lot of confusion around that. So they know when they've sort of crossed that line into, okay, it's time to get some professional advice at this point. There's so much. I feel like parents are so barraged with information with the internet, and they get sort of get, you know, analysis paralysis. They get too much information and then they don't know what to do. So I wanted to provide a very simple framework so that they can really process what they need to and understand what's going on. So I started working with children, teenage boys primarily, that were in the court system. And obviously a lot of their behaviors were very extreme. And I found that I really loved working with that population. And I worked a lot with children in the foster care system as well. So when I went into private practice, it was a different population of families, but I was seeing very similar here and there that these extreme behaviors, drug use, suicidal behavior, cutting, antisocial behaviors, social skills, you know, a lot of deficiencies in social skills. So I started to really try to help parents understand what part of this is within the norm and what part of it is beyond, what part of it's extreme. And does it need to be addressed in a different way?
So why did you love these children? You said you loved working with these children, and probably most people are going, whoa, you know, I don't want to deal with these people.
Yes. And it takes a very specific kind of person to work well with teenagers. Teenagers are very difficult. And I've often heard therapists in the field say, you know, the two populations that are the hardest to work with is marriage counseling and teenagers. And those happen to be my two favorite groups of people to work with. I like the challenge, but I also come from, I was an extreme teenager myself. I was very rebellious. I went, put my parents through a lot of things. And in that time, so I can really resonate. A lot of the times, a lot of the behaviors that I see with these teenagers is really just them. They're acting out because they're looking for a connection. They're not, you know, and what happens is, as parents, we get very involved in the discipline part of the process. And we don't really look beneath there to see what's driving that behavior. Lots of times the behavior has to do with emotional needs that are unmet and they're unable to express.
Now their behavior seems to be saying the exact opposite, right? I don't like you, keep away from me. And you said, but you say underneath that, they really want connection.
Yes.
So it would take a brave parent to push through that persistently, right?
Yes. In the book, I use the metaphor of, imagine that your teenager is a goldfish wearing a shark fin. And all you can see is the shark fin. So all you do is you look at this shark fin and you try to figure out how to keep yourself safe, how to keep that shark safe, how to get out of the way of this shark. But we fail to notice that beneath the surface is this very gentle, very fragile goldfish that really needs the attention. And if we work towards understanding what's going on with the goldfish, we don't pay need to pay attention to the shark fin as much.
Wow, that is... a great metaphor. And I like that in the book you did share that you were an extremely difficult teen. And and yet you say that you don't blame your parents. It wasn't bad parenting that got you there.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I think it's really important to understand. I think that my parents did the best they could with the tools they had. They were very traditional, but I required, it's sort of like they were trying to parent me with the tools that work for my siblings. I have three siblings. But I needed power tools. I needed a much different way of managing, because I was very intense. And I was very fragile inside. I was that goldfish with the shark fin. And I don't think my parents really understood that. And I think that happens with a lot of teenagers. You know, we look at the parenting books and we do what the book says, and then it doesn't work. And then we try another parenting model, and then we try this. I mean, there's thousands of books on Amazon on parenting. And if it was an easy thing, there wouldn't be thousands of books available about parenting.
So how did you get past being the difficult teenager that you were?
After college, I started really paying attention to the fact that I was sort of the common denominator in a lot of the chaos that was going on in my life.
So I followed you in some ways to college.
Absolutely, through college. And I those are some blurry years. And I, you know, had some very self-destructive, risky behavior. Uh-huh. And it took therapy. I had a wonderful therapist who was very patient with me and spent, a year just really digging in and understanding what my role was and how I was sort of creating this scenario over and over, and I didn't want to live in this chaos anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the publicity around your book refers to you as the teen whisperer. Is that a title you gave yourself, or where did that idea come from?
You know, people have called me that over the years just because I can have teenagers who everyone's afraid of. I mean, they look like they are described. I'm waiting to meet sometimes these 10-foot fire-breathing dragons. And I can look at a child, no matter what size they are, and understand what's going on beneath the surface. And it's sort of like, I don't know if you've ever worked with horses, but horses are a lot like teenagers. They can really feel your energy. They can decide if they trust you. If they don't trust how they feel around you, they won't respond to you in the same way. And I think that teenagers are very similar to that. They don't care what I'm saying with my words. They care more about how I'm connecting with them. They care more about feeling understood and seen. And they feel more connected when they feel seen, loved, and heard. And that's really what I try to do when I work with them. The discipline comes after that. And that's what I tell parents. In this framework of the Bravo effect, the first piece of that is behavior, because that's what gets our attention as parents, right? Then after that, I have parents really look at the relationship. Like, what's going on between the two of you? What is your relationship as a parent with your child? What is your relationship with your co-parent? How are we all working together? And then attitude. The A stands for attitude. What is the attitude your teenager is taking? Lots of times attitude is a loaded word, but I look at it in terms of understanding what position are they taking. Oh, are you okay?
Yeah, I am. I get this little chronic cough. I think it started with the fires a year or two ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Northern California.
I know. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I think you're on fire again, aren't you?
They're just getting started again, I think. It's a horrible thought. But at any rate, it sounds like you're spelling out Bravo, B-R-A-V-O?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it's behavior.
Behavior, relationship, attitude, values, and opportunities.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great, because I was somehow I missed that going through the book, and that was going to be my concluding question was, well, what is the Bravo effect?
Right.
you really kind of spell it out.
Right. So the way that I came up with the title is I really wanted to have this framework for parents to be able to look at what was going on from a very kind of multi-systemic way, not just one way. It has to be very dynamic. And once all those things are working together, it creates the effect that you want. It's kind of a play on words. You know, you kind of get this Bravo response.
There you go, Bravo.
Bravo, here we go. Like, we've got everything working in conjunction.
And your name is Bravo, your last name is Bravo.
And my name is Bravo.
Yeah, so it all flows together. Another way in which your book is pretty unique is that you have a warning in the introduction that says, "This book is not for the faint of heart."
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don't go into this book unless you can handle what I'm going to tell you.
Right. Well, you know, my editors, I kind of went round and round when I was working with my editors. The book initially was going to be a lot, you know, very soft version of how to parent teenagers. And I felt very passionate that it was, you know, there aren't books for this extreme behavior. And parents really are looking for answers and help, and they need immediate responses and they need the right information. So I, you know, we kind of went round and round, and finally we decided that we would put sort of a caveat in the beginning, like this is very direct information, and some of it might be upsetting for some parents, but it's very much about the world of teenagers, and we have to know what they're living in. With the internet and everything that they're exposed to, these teenagers have so much they have to navigate, and we really have to have a full understanding of what that is in order to parent them.
Yeah, one of the questions that came up for me, and I think your references to the internet maybe answer the question, which is sort of, well, what's going on? It wasn't always this way. It seems like there's a lot more, a much larger gulf between parents and kids than used to be.
Well, and I think really, you know, having all of these devices and electronics is really, you know, we saw with the when the smartphones first came into being and teenagers started having them, that's when we started seeing increases in depression, anxiety, suicide, drug use, all of those things. And we know that there is, you know, a physiological response that happens in the body. There's a change in the brain that happens every time they check their streaks on, or their numbers, or their this or their that. If they get enough likes, all of that, their lives have become about how many likes they get. The problem with having these social kind of organizations with teenagers is they're fleeting. They move a lot, they change a lot, and they're not really substantial relationships. So I've seen a lot of teenagers who are, you know, they may have 1,000 friends online, but that they feel so lonely inside because they don't have connection, human connection with other teenagers.
Yeah, I've got grandkids who are now entering into the teen range and seeing that, you know, and then amplified by a year of distancing, you know, due to COVID.
Right. Yes. I think the pandemic has compounded things exponentially.
Yeah.
One of two things have happened. Either families have kind of pulled together and have gotten a lot more cohesive, or families have gotten farther apart. We know the suicide rates among teenagers has skyrocketed in the last year. The anxiety and depression rates have also skyrocketed, and we are attributing it to the pandemic. But also, I think part of it is it's really important for parents to understand that even if their children want these devices, what we are doing is we are literally, I mean, I always ask parents, before you make the decision to allow your tweenager, because the average age that children are getting smartphones right now is 9 years old. It used to be 16. So it's 9 years old. You're giving your child this $1,000 device that literally gives them access to the entire world. So you're, it's like
including
putting them
on all the evil that's in the world.
Right. It's like putting them on a plane and just to wherever they want to go and having them try to figure it out.
And their brain is not at a place where it can make good judgments about that.
They're
stuff.
Not ready. Their brains are not ready. And and we also know that all of this, these devices, there's a lot of research to support that it changes the architecture of the brain. So it's really, you know, we're very careful about giving, you know, drugs to our children. People are very diligent about researching that. But devices also change the architecture of the brain. So it's really important to know what you're handing your child and to put those, I say, put those boundaries in place right away. And don't call it, kids don't have a right to privacy. You know, their phones should never be private until they're driving age, maybe, and you feel like you can trust them. But I think giving your child a phone and not allowing and not establishing a rule around, this is just like your bedroom. I tell parents all the time, would you let your child go into their bedroom and lock the door every day and never let you come in? And you're hearing parties going on and you're hearing all kinds of things happening. Would you just go, okay, well, it's private. It's their private room. No parent has ever said yes to that. Yeah. Think of their phone like their bedroom.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, I agree with you totally. I say unfortunately because reflexively coming up when I came up, I was a big fan of technology and have been a techno lover to this day in many ways. But I've been forced to recognize the dark underside of all of this, that there's a real shadow side and that young people don't have the equipment yet cognitively to deal with it. So I agree that there have to be strict guidelines. But of course, there are a lot of parents out there that don't have those guidelines for themselves in many ways, right? So it almost demands more maturity of parents than many come equipped with.
Well, and I think there's a lot of parents too that don't even really, they think their kids are just going to use it to text their friends and do this and that. But when they're alone with their device in their bedroom, there's a lot of things that they get. Kids are curious by nature, where they're scientists. So to expect that they're not going to look around and be curious about different things is just unreasonable. So we really have to be realistic about what our kids are curious about, what their friends may be talking about, and understand that that device gives them access. Now, if your child already has a device, which most parents do, it's a lot harder to establish rules and boundaries later. It's a lot harder to install some of these apps. There's some very good apps that you can install that will help kind of manage some of that understand what where your child's going and get notifications if your child is going into, you know, chat rooms that are dangerous for them or the dark web or any of those kinds of things. But oftentimes it's been my experience that parents find out way after the fact that their kids are in the woods.
Yeah, yeah. So not only do you have the guardian at the gate that you're giving this warning, you know, about this book, there's also a carrot that you offer in relation to crisis. And, you know, we don't like crisis in our lives. We want to avoid it. But you do say that crisis can really be a valuable thing. Say a little bit about that.
Sure. So I know in my field, most people end up on my doorstep when they're in crisis. They don't just come in for family therapy when everything's going great. So it's been my experience that that crisis window is so important. I actually used to work for a crisis mobile team with the police department in Maricopa County. And one of the things that I learned is when families are on the heels of a crisis or a catastrophic event, it is a very fertile ground for change to happen. And it's an opportunity for them to change patterns, to really look at what's going on and to shift what, how they're parenting or how they're interacting as a family.
Yeah. Yeah. You write about three different types of stress, speaking of crisis, that there are three types of stress that you identify, which you label as positive, tolerable, and toxic. So tell us about those three and you know, which types of stress the extreme teen is likely to get.
Right. That's a great question. And I'm glad you asked it because I think what happens sometimes with parents is they see all stress as bad. And that's not necessarily true. Positive stress is really important for children to experience and be exposed to so that they learn how to tolerate that feeling of stress in their bodies. So positive stress is things like studying for a test, time management, sports. There's a lot of stress involved in sports, but you're working towards a goal and there's a meaning to the stress. There's a lot of parents that really try to kind of shield their children from any kind of distress. And that's not necessarily the best thing for them because they have to learn how to manage in healthy ways when they're feeling distressed.
So,
positive stress, we want to expose them to as much as possible. Tolerable stress are, kind of a higher level of stress, but they're also stressors that I think teenagers can recover from. So things like maybe a death of a pet, a death in the family, anything that is, going on within the family system, but there is still healthy functioning demonstration around them. So the parents are maybe they're going through a divorce. You know, that's a tolerable stress if the parents aren't constantly fighting in front of the children and they talk to them about what's going on and they can be part of that process. So if it's managed in a healthy way and it's modeled in a healthy way from the parents, the kids can get through those things really, really well.
Yeah, and it's part of being of human experiences, the existential issues, and it adds to the depth of the personality to have had some challenges and gone through some difficult things.
And
learn to come through the other side. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let me break in here to tell you about today's exciting sponsor, EveryPlate. There are so many meal kits out there, but what sets every plate apart is the combination of quality and affordability. Every plate dinners are the less expensive and more fulfilling alternative to takeout or delivery. More bang for your buck. Every plate provides easy-to-follow recipe cards and pre-portioned ingredients so you can spend less time prepping and cooking and more time enjoying good food with family or loved ones. Our first box included with everything we needed for three good tasting meals, sriracha pork stir fry, garlic rosemary chicken, and sweet and tangy cherry meatballs. Recipes come together in about 30 minutes, definitely faster than a trip to a grocery store and starting a meal from scratch. This time, we decided to make sweet and tangy cherry meatballs with two of our grandkids as the chefs under our watchful supervision. Together, we all ended up pulling it off with the help of their clear step-by-step directions and all the needed ingredients. I have to say, this is a great family activity. Now you can get started with every plate for just $1.99 per meal, plus an additional 20% off another 2 weeks by going to everyplate.com and entering the code SHRINK199. That's up to $100 value. So once again, get started with every plate for just $1.99 per meal, plus an additional 20% off for another 2 weeks by going to everyplate.com and entering the code SHRINK199. Now, back to the interview.
The toxic stress is sort of this one that I think many people have experienced. And toxic stress is repeated sort of being in a stressful environment that's dysfunctional and unhealthy for a long period of time. Abuse, neglect, being exposed to violence, all of those, having parents who maybe have a substance abuse issue and they're, exposing their child to it repeatedly. All of these kinds of stressors really do affect who we are and how we're shaped as children. And it later affects us as adults. There is a really great, and I talk about it in the book, there's a measurement tool that they use in pediatrician offices now called ACEs, which is it really measures childhood adverse childhood experiences.
Yes, right.
And it was one of the largest studies ever done. And what they were able to determine is the higher your ACE score, they ask about if you were ever exposed to violence, if you ever had a parent who was in jail or died or was incarcerated, if you were exposed to drugs or alcohol or violence and those kinds of questions. And it's a very simple tool. But what they found is the higher the ACE score, the higher people were likely to have later issues, cardiac problems, obesity, depression, anxiety. They were more likely to be smokers or substance users. And it's really interesting because we can use that information to really understand that exposing children to toxic stress, we do have protective factors. It's not like if you have a child who is exposed to these things that they're going to be ruined as an adult. I don't want parents to think that, but what you have to do then is really teach them healthy ways of coping, healthy ways of managing, healthy ways of processing that toxic environment they were in or whatever they were exposed to, so that they can have a way to be resilient from it.
Yeah, and it may not be just in the home. It could be in the neighborhood. It could be in the school that they attend.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And school is a very big one. Bullying is, you know, really, really hard on kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And so what are some of the ways that parents can help to ameliorate these things to, you know, provide a home life that will create the resilience that we're looking for?
Right. That's a great question. I think the biggest piece is connection. I know that teenagers look like they don't want to be around us and they give us the side eye when we pull out the board games. And my daughter used to even call board game. She thought it was spelled B-O-R-E-D. She's like,
yeah, no wonder they're called board games.
They're called board games.
Boring.
And yeah, but I think, you know, just establishing routines where connection is your intention. I think even having a night where everyone in the family is unplugged and you play games together or you go and do activities together, but there's no devices. Just one night a week, everyone agrees. Spending time with your teenagers, it makes such a huge difference. And I used to do this with my son because he went through a very dark period where I could not connect with him, but I found if I would come into his room while he's playing his games, and by the way, I do not like video games, but that was his world. So I would just lay on his floor and watch him play and ask him questions about his game and his avatar and who's this, who are you playing with? I was in his world, and that made a world of difference in the way that he felt seen by me. I didn't say anything about his dirty socks on the floor. I didn't say anything about the dishes. This is not a time to give a lecture. It's a time to intentionally and purposefully connect with your child.
That's a good story, good tip. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my sons was, we were concerned. He was just playing video games so much. It seemed to be his whole world. Mm-hmm. And yet he's come through it all partly because of the girl that he met and later was able to marry. Mm-hmm. He just turned his whole life around in terms of maintaining a loving relationship and now being a father himself. And his great affection to video games actually was a doorway into the world of technology, you know, which has gotten integrated into his work. So it's not it's not necessarily bad, particularly if there are these counterbalancing things in their lives, and the one that you just outlined for us, I think, was terrific. Of, I'm here, I'm watching this. Tell me about showing some interest, because as an adult, there's no way you can play at their level.
That's
the other thing that's kind of, in a way, you can. It's got two aspects potentially. I mean, the kid can discover competence. Their own competence at an early age and competence beyond that of the adults around them, which in a way is a good thing if it's building up a sense of self-competence. But on the other hand, it can be a bad thing because then they want to tune out the adults and think they don't know anything.
Right, right. But I also have found, like, when I ask for help on my computer doing something, that was a way that my son could feel like he was, like, you know, showing me how to do something. He was in control of the process. And I think it was really a good way to connect with him. But I think the biggest thing is with parents, we have such busy lives and we really have to intentionally stop and be with them and be present with them. I think parents are so busy and they've got so many hats that they wear. And sometimes they'll tell me, well, I didn't have time to connect with him today. And I literally call it connection. I want you to sit and I want you to be with him. And 5 minutes a day, sometimes that's the homework assignment I give the parent. And they, I didn't get to do it every day. And the thing is, if it doesn't become your intention, it won't happen. You'll run out of time, I promise. But we always figure out how to make time for being angry, how to make time for conflict. We always can, everything stops when we're having an argument, right? So it's really important to make it as important as having conflict, like, or more important actually, to really be in that space. Initially, your kids are going to reject you. If this isn't some way you've worked with them before, they're going to reject it. But don't let that deter you because eventually, you know, they don't want to get dependent on that connection if there hasn't been good connection between the two of you, because what if it stops? They have to know that you're going to outlast them. So I tell parents, don't be attached to their response. Give it 6 weeks. You do this every day for 6 weeks. And then you tell me if it's changed. All the time, every time, every parent who's been consistent, they have a different relationship with their teenager after that time period, if they've been really diligent about that connection and not being attached to reciprocal relationship for that first 6 weeks.
Yeah. You know, so many of us are addicted to our phones, to our smartphones. Mm-hmm. And it alarms me when I'm out in the world and I'll see parents pushing a pram, you know, a buggy or a toddler.
A stroller.
Thank you. That's the word I'm missing here. And they're looking at their phone at the same time, or their kids are pulling on their clothing in the playground, trying to get their attention.
Yes.
And attention is what kids want. It's what we all want. That's why I do this. I want attention. I want an audience. And we all crave, hey, look at me, right? And that's so important for kids coming up to have those looks and to get that attention. It's as important as food.
Well, and think about what happens with toddlers. When we model that behavior, they do the same thing. And then we tell them, get off your phone. And if I'm on my phone all the time, parents will say, well, I'm working. They're not working, but that they don't understand the delineation. They need you to say, we're all going to put our phones down for an hour, or there's no phones at the table. But the parent also has to do the same thing. They have to be willing to turn off the phone and to model that behavior.
Yeah.
And think about when toddlers are at the park, you know, the way they get that attention is what? By throwing themselves on the ground or fighting with another child, or eventually they will get that parent to show up either on the positive side or the negative side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that a lot of time parents are wondering or asking you, is my child normal? Does my child have problems? And you've got a chapter or more in the book about sort of normal teen development.
Right.
Can you kind of give us the overview of that?
Yeah. I think it's so important because I have so many parents. Sometimes I'm their first stop, and it really is concerning to me that they don't think about child development. We have so much information about mental health, and their parents are very diligent, and they're trying to educate themselves, and they get a lot of information about parenting from a mental health perspective. But sometimes they don't understand the developmental side. So I always look at through the lens, teenagers through the lens of developmental appropriate. What are they doing at this stage? What is important for them to learn and master at this stage? And a lot of behavior that parents will come to me with concerns, a lot of it's developmentally appropriate, you know, being angsty, being moody, having weird sleep patterns, having weird, you know, changes in their food, all of a sudden, things like that. That all happens with all of the hormones coming into their body. They're going into puberty. Their bodies are changing for the first time. They feel very out of control, and they're not necessarily, their brains aren't developed. The human brain, we know now, is not developed until 25. Yeah. So, We can't expect our children to make, you know, the front temporal lobes of the brain are the part of the brain that sort of develop last. And that's where logic and reasoning comes from. So if your child is making these irrational decisions and has this impulsive behavior, that's really their front temporal lobes have not completely, they're not completely developed yet. And so that's why you see all these deficits sometimes in the way they react and respond. Because they're still trying to learn how to do that. So that's normal. That's not mental health. Mental health issues come up when there's safety issues and when there's dangerous behavior and things like that.
Yeah. So a major topic is addiction. And you discuss that in the book. And, you know, that's pretty heavy duty, and drugs, really, really dangerous drugs, are more and more available in our society. So, how do parents deal with the issues around teen addiction to steer their teens away from it to begin with? But what if you have a teen who's already addicted? How do you recognize it, and what do you do?
Right. So, I think that is a really complex question. It's a very important question. I don't know how many parents of teenagers are aware, but I mean, there are kids who get drugs delivered to their front door on Snapchat. I mean, guns get delivered to their front door on Snapchat. The drug dealers are using these apps, Snapchat, WhatsApp, these ones that are anonymous, where they don't, you can't see what they're writing. They are using them for fun and to communicate, but some kids are also using them as a gateway to getting drugs and illicit behavior. So it's really important that you are aware of what your child is doing in those apps, because there's a lot of nefarious activity. What I would say about if you think your child is using drugs, well, first of all, prevention is a very big piece, but I know some very loving, very connected parents who have children who have fallen prey to drug addiction. So it's not just parenting. There's a lot of other factors that play into it. And, you know, what their peer groups are like, do they belong? Where do they belong? All of those things play into whether a child is going to make that decision or not. So what I would say is the most important, I guess, preventative factor for parents is to talk to your kids about drugs. From the time I've talked to my kids about drugs and alcohol since they were 4 or 5 years old, I started very early so that they understand, not from a fear place, but like, so this is what some people do sometimes. And then this is maybe what happens, or, you know, to have it be an open discussion, not a taboo discussion, because I think if kids can ask about things as they come up and they feel like they have an open dialogue with you, they can ask you anything, they're more willing to talk to you about it and they're more likely to talk about it. Now, if they're already in the throes of an addiction, it is very important that you understand what they're addicted to. There are some very, very dangerous drugs that are unfortunately very easy to get. In Arizona, they have legalized marijuana. So legal at age 21, but there's a lot more availability to kids, and there's a lot, it's a lot easier to hide. So what I tell parents is really from the beginning when they start to drive. So in Arizona, you can get your learner's permit when you're 15 and a half. So I have them lay the groundwork right when high school starts about driving. So one of the ways that you get to drive is getting up on time with your own alarm clock, getting dressed and ready so you don't have to rush. So we start working on that when they're 14. Yeah. And this is the carrot at the end of that stick is driving, right?
Right.
But the other thing that I think is very important, I am a licensed substance abuse counselor as well, is that they should drug test. And the reason that I say that, not because they think their kids are on drugs, but the way I have parents understand it is it's sort of like if you're going to give them your car, think about it like your company car. If you're driving a company car, most companies require drug testing. And that's just part of driving their company vehicle. If you're going to drive on my insurance policy, I'm going to drug test you because I need to make sure that you're a safe driver and I'm not putting you in a car if you're impaired. And if you start early and you just set that as that's just part of the expectation, it's not, I'm not going to wait to bust you. It's a way that I'm going to build trust with you. And with my teenagers who have been using drugs, when they get clean, one of the things that I ask of them is that they allow parents to continue to drug test them because each time they have a clean test, they're building trust with their parent. And sometimes they have to start there.
How does a parent get their kid drug tested? This is new to me. I mean, that's, to me, my first reaction, thinking of my own kids and fortunately out of the house now, the adults, successful adults, but now we've got the grandkids.
Right.
That sounds pretty heavy duty.
Well, here's the thing. You can buy them on in bulk on Amazon, and they're usually, I mean, they've gotten so inexpensive. They're like $3 a piece. And it's, you know, if it's just a safety net. It also helps children, especially teenagers. And I've told my own children, and this is how I talk to parents about it. It gives kids a way out. So if you're sitting at a bonfire and everyone's passing a joint around, I can say, you know what? My mom is crazy. She drug tests me. I can't do that or I'll lose the car. It gives them an out and it gives them a reason that they can say no.
Yeah. And so these are urine tests, I guess. Is that right?
Well, they have urine tests, but they also have saliva tests.
Oh, really?
So you just chew on this little sponge and then you put it in the thing and it will tell you if there's, those are a little less, THC primarily is what you test for with those, but you can also, there's also some panel tests that will, that you can use saliva for. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I also tell, so here's my tricky teenagers. They will put whatever they can in that test if they're dirty to put in the urine. So what I tell parents is if they have an inconclusive test, that's automatically negative. Inconclusive test would mean that there's some substance in there besides urine. And the test will say it's inconclusive. So if kids are putting toilet water in there, you can detect it. They've gotten very good. Now I want to make sure that it's stressed that this is not the only, you know, this is not the only tool in the box. This is one of many tools that you use to parent and connect and have an open dialogue with your child. And drug testing is just one of the tools. It's not like the only thing that you're going to do, because if you only do that, you're going to get rebellion.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So it gives me some things to think about.
I know. A lot to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad I'm further along in the maturity game to not have to deal with all of this stuff in today's world where there are criminal elements that are under that are figuring out how to get us,
how to get around us,
how to get around us, how to get our money, how to, you know.
Right.
It's just such a challenging world that we live in now.
Well, and that's why it's so important to teach our kids like how to manage those things, because if we don't talk to them about it, their teacher becomes the internet.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I don't want the internet to parent my children.
Right. So what have we not touched on here that you really want to have people know?
I think, you know, my favorite chapter in the book, but I think it may be the shortest chapter, is the end, the part about opportunity. Uh-huh. I wouldn't say I'm like this positive person all the time, but I believe that every situation that you are exposed to with your child or your teenager, there, if it's a negative experience, there's always an opportunity. So if parents can just take a breath and wait and just decide, okay, what's the opportunity here? You know, their behavior is sometimes shocking. Their behavior sometimes breaks our hearts. Their behavior makes us angry. But if we can be really aware of what's going on inside of ourselves and put that to the side and really deal with what's going on with that teenager, and we can find the opportunity in the moment, it might be the pivot point that changes their life.
Can you give an example of a conversation like that? Where?
Yes. Actually, I'll tell you a story that I share in the book about my son, with his permission, of course. This kid, he gave me, I'm like, I'm sure, are you sure you want me? Am I allowed to tell this story? So Christopher was my kiddo that really, I learned a lot about myself and about parenting from him. He taught me so much. There was a point when he was a teenager, and I was there, and I was asking him, you know, to go do his laundry, you know, go get your laundry. Oh, I was pulling the laundry upstairs and I said, put your laundry away. And he's, you know, playing his video games and ignoring me. And I said, Christopher, do it right now. Come here right now. I made him come out of his room, come to the steps. We are toe to toe in this moment. And I find it's one of those moments. I don't know if this has happened to you, but you know, when you all of a sudden realize your child is taller than you, it just happened overnight, and I'm looking up at him.
Yes, I have. I've
and
had that
I'm
experience.
Thinking, yeah, and I'm thinking, wow, he is just enormous. Like he's so tall. So he's standing there and he's fuming. His nostrils are flaring. He's got his fists in the air. He's mad. He is going to fight me. And we're standing in the second floor of my house, and we're next to this railing. And I thought, this kid could throw me right over with one arm. He was a hockey player. He's 6'3". I'm a big kid.
Yeah.
And he's looking at me. And I was thinking, I thought, I'm so glad I never spanked you when you were a child, because right now would be a perfect time for you to use violence with me, you know, as a way to get me in control.
Yeah.
I was out of control. I realized that I was yelling and screaming, and I said, right now, because I said so. And so we're toe to toe looking at each other, and I had to decide, what am I going to do next? Where's the opportunity? Right. And I looked at him and I just started laughing. And he looked at me and he was like, what? And I'm like, nothing, nothing, nothing. And I just start laughing because I'm thinking, this kid, I mean, he's so big and he could just throw me over. And he says, he looks at me and I said, I moved back and I said, I'm really glad I never spanked you when you were young, because you, I know, could take me with one arm and throw me right over this railing. That's what I was just thinking. And I'm still laughing. And I can see him just relaxing and his shoulders are coming back down and he's, you know, getting out of that limbic state, that fight or flee state that kids get into so easily when they're that age. And he's breathing. And as I'm breathing, he's breathing. I never tell kids to breathe when I work with them. I just start breathing deeply and purposefully, and then they start doing it. So that's another little trick that I've learned along the way. And I start breathing. He starts calming down and relaxing and breathing. He's following my cues nonverbally. And I said to him, you know what, Christopher, I need to apologize to you because you were busy and I did not respect what you were doing. I wasn't respectful and I was being irresponsible with my authority. And I really, really want to apologize to you because that is not the way that I want to parent you. And I would like to move forward. And when you're ready to put this laundry away, I would love for you to do it. And he was like, oh, I'll do it right now, Mom. And that was it. That was the end of the story because I took pause and I said, this is, I have to take responsibility for how I just handled this. And the moment I stepped back and did that, he was ready to do whatever I wanted because I was treating him with respect. I wasn't using my authority or my power inappropriately, and I took responsibility. So there was the opportunity there for me to, first of all, tell him, I know I'm not perfect as your mother. Second of all, to model for him what it looks like when a person takes responsibility. And number three, how to de-escalate when you're ready to throw someone over a banister. He learned all of those things in that moment.
And you learned, right?
I learned a lot that day. That was a very meaningful moment for me.
Yeah.
And it's a situation parents probably have at least once a week, right?
Yeah. I'm not going to tell my stories, but a couple stories came up as you're telling that one. It's a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a way that people can find you or get more information from or about you that you'd like to put out here before we wrap up?
Sure. You can find me and the book at www.thebravoeffect.com. And I'm in the process of putting together some coaching and consultation packages. So stay tuned. It's going to be really cool. But we're working on putting a community together for parent support. But right now we've got the book, and I think that's a great starting point.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Well, I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you, and you're a very, very dynamic person. And delightful. And so, Lisa Bravo, Dr. Lisa Bravo, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure being here.
Teen Whisperer, indeed. I can see why today's guest, Dr. Lisa Bravo, has earned that worshipful nickname. She's really done her work in the trenches as well as academically. By her own estimation, she's worked with thousands of troubled teens and families. In our interview, she didn't do much whispering. Instead, her voice is strong, passionate, and authoritative. Clearly, she has both the strength and the compassion this work requires. Her book opens with a long poem signed by her. It really renders the challenge and her philosophical and practical bottom line. I'm sure she won't mind me sharing it here. So it reads as follows. It's titled, See Me Anyway. I am a whirling dervish, untethered, wreaking havoc. I push and pull frantically and chaotically, unsure of my target. Fear me, I am a steel wall affixed with razor wire, resistant and sharp, so safe, so disaffected. Yet behind this wall lies my truth, broken and confused inside and out. Fear and self-loathing prevail. I am too much for me, for you, for them. Always too much. Frozen in time, no way to navigate this storm. Cannot imagine what the future holds. Misunderstood, mistaken, misfit. I have become numb and unfeeling. I take refuge in the familiar chaos of dancing in the fire. Within it, I feel, I connect, I love. When we dance in the fire, I feel your love, your connection. You dance with me every single time. I feel alive and seen and terrified to change. I scream for you. See me. Love me. Fight for me. My actions are my fear, not my heart. Hold on even tighter as I let go. Anchor me through the storm. Will you still see me if there is no danger? Hear me if there is no scream? Hold me without restraint? Will you see me anyway? I will dare to change, desperate to know you will see me then. Hold on tighter or just let go? I want to share it all with you, but I'm afraid. Good, bad, ugly. Will you see me anyway? Love me more than I know how to love me. Show me how to start again. The fight makes me stronger, the struggle even more clever. I need the fight to teach me that I'm not alone. Love me despite the chaos. Be my beacon in the storm. Steady, bright, unwavering, tethered. When you do, I will learn to survive, to strive, and then eventually to thrive. And that's by Lisa M. Bravo. As you heard in our discussion, today's world is more challenging than ever for both adults and teens. If you are struggling with an extreme teen, I highly recommend you get this 2021 book, The Bravo Effect, Strategies for Parenting Extreme Teens by Dr. Lisa Bravo.
Hey there, this is Louise from Australia. I just wanted to let you all know how good I feel about donating to Shrink Wrap Radio. It's such an awesome show. I really love each week. There's just something different and something fantastic to be able to learn about and contribute towards my own personal growth. And I think that it's only fair that we give something back. So how about you go on there, click on that PayPal button, and give Dr. Dave the boost he deserves. Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind.
Thank you, Louise Callanan, way down in Australia. Thank you for that spirited call for others to follow your fine example. You'll get no argument from me about that. Time to wrap it up. Shrink Wrap It Up. Once again, big thanks go out to today's guest, Dr. Lisa Bravo, a.k.a. the Teen Whisperer, for sharing her wisdom and experience in working with extreme teens, and for telling us about her book, The Bravo Effect, which is a guide parents need to create genuine connections with their teenage kids, even amidst extreme misunderstood behavior. Be sure to join us next week when my guest will be cognitive neuroscientist Dr. Christian Jarrett, author of Be Who You Want. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.